have you ever started raking leaves at a particular moment because either the wind wasn't blowing at all, or better yet, it was blowing the direction you wanted the leaves to go? Anybody ever start the job? What happens, Silas, as soon as you get good and started?
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
Good morning. How many of you are familiar with the concept of hitching your wagon to a particular person, particular cause? Sometimes you say hitch your wagon to a star or whatever else. Sometimes we use that idea as an idiom that isn't really about wagons or horses, but it follows that idea. You don't think you can pull your wagon to where you would like to get it yourself, so you hitch it to a good strong horse who you think will get it there. Political handlers have been known to take hold of promising young candidates in small-time local offices because they feel like, man, this kid has got what it takes. This kid could go to the state senate and then to the national congress and maybe one day be governor of a state, and who knows, maybe go even further than that. And if it means right now that I am the chief volunteer managing volunteers unpaid for elections to township trustee, county commissioner, and state rep, but it ends up with me being paid chief of staff for the governor of a state, I will hitch my wagon to this candidate. And people do that, and sometimes they're disappointed. Sometimes they're not. Marriages have been, and I presume continue in places, to be managed the same way. A person of either gender wishing to be firmly attached to someone who they think is going to make it. It happens in the business world as well, when the secretaries and gophers who labored so hard with the man with the startup that became successful end up high up in the multinational concern when it gets there. All the wagon hitching scenarios involve the same assumptions, and I don't really mean to be putting that practice down. It can be selfish and calculating and manipulative. I don't think that it always is. I think that most of the time it is not. There are those who will not be content with less than the leading role, fame, in the center of the stage. And there are those who are more comfortable backstage and in the supporting roles and can do a lot of good from those positions. And if that's where you would rather be, nothing to be said about that. And if you're going to be in a supporting role, is it not just as well to be supporting someone or some cause that is going to be successful as one that is going to flop? And the big shot politician, the entrepreneur, the celebrity, whoever, is going to need help and probably won't get where they could get without help that you can provide. Maybe we can do more good that way, and there's no trouble with that. So hitch them wagons, but choose the horse carefully. Acts chapter 27. Paul has appealed to Rome, which surely everybody here knows by now. Paul has appealed to Rome, and Porcius Festus has written whatever kind of report that he could cobble together about this strange, complicated case of the Apostle Paul, and he has put Paul in the care of a particular Roman centurion named Julius, and Paul and Julius and others, soldiers and other prisoners, etc., have got on a boat, and when that boat got to where it was going, they found another boat that was sailing for Italy, and they got on that boat, but they got a late start, and the weather has been contrary, and one way and another, they are behind schedule. We know from the reference to the Jewish feast in this chapter that it is just about the same time of year that we are currently enjoying, mid-October, just a little later in the month than it is for us, but it's about this time of year, and this is the time when voyages like the one under consideration are supposed to be over, because late October and the whole month of November bring to that part of the world bad weather for sailing. And it's worse, this second ship that Paul and company have boarded is a grain hauler with a primary cargo of wheat, which also serves as ballast. Secondary cargoes of whatever somebody would pay you to stack on top of the wheat. These boats were worse for this kind of thing because they were essentially one sail boats with a mast, and they didn't do well at all in the bad weather. But they made constant trips from the provinces to Rome, because if you keep your people in line with bread and circuses, you got to have the bread. So the wheat had to keep going to Rome for the population, but they generally waited out these shipments late October and the entire month of November. This ship would have been about 140 feet long. Try to remember these dimensions roughly for a minute. 140 feet long. 36 feet wide, 30 to 33 feet like that. They were not passenger ships under any set of circumstances. There were no cabins. There were no staterooms. Passengers booked at the last minute after all the cargo had been put in and saw what room was left. And passengers figured to find a nook where they could lay on top of a bag of wheat between a bale of hides and whatever else they could find to lay on, or they slept on deck if they could find a place to stay out of the way of the sailors who would kick you or step on you without any concern for you if you happened to be in their way. There was no shuffleboard. There was no swimming pool. There was no buffet. It was not that kind of ship. And that kind of arrangement, it was going to be uncomfortable and cold and very unprivate. And with all the people, Paul, the centurion, his soldiers, other prisoners that they had, the crew, a few more passengers that we don't know about may have put into the number, but there were just short of 300 people on this 140-foot boat. Who were going to have to find some place to sleep and some way to live for the duration of the voyage. The best news they could have is that this kind of trip usually took about a week in September. But it was not September. It was October. And everyone involved agreed they needed to winter over. By the second week in December, the storm season will have passed, and then they could more safely set sail for Italy. But the harbor that they are in wasn't a particularly good place for wintering over. It wasn't close to a big town with a lot of accommodations, and nobody was looking forward to spending 40, 50, 60 days on the boat. And there was a better harbor just a little further along the coast of Crete. And it just so happened that at this moment, an unusual, unseasonal, read the whole chapter, south wind had kicked up, which looked like it ought to drive them right to that better harbor so that they could spend the extra months in comparative comfort. Paul mistrusts the situation. He says they ought to stay right where they are, discomforts and inconveniences notwithstanding. The captain of the ship, the owner of the ship, the contractor, and the centurion think they should take advantage of this unusual south wind and make for the better harbor and winter there. Now, whom do you think gets listened to? The captain of the ship, the military officer, and the owner contractor of the ship, or one of the prisoners? So they set sail, and they take off in this south wind, headed for better harbor. Now, I am not any kind of a sailor at all. Any sailors got one over here, got one who's sailed. All right. Well, you know more about that than me. I am not any kind of sailor, so I'll fall back to something that I know a little bit about and something that we can have some common experience with. It's almost leaf raking season. Oh boy, right? Oh boy. How many of you ever started raking leaves at a particular moment because either the wind wasn't blowing at all, or better yet, it was blowing the direction you wanted the leaves to go? Anybody ever start the job? What happens, Silas, as soon as you get good and started? The wind changes, and not only does it change direction, it usually picks up velocity about that time too. So it makes your job much, much harder. I have cut down a lot of trees. A couple of times I have been cutting down trees where when I first put blade to the trunk of the tree, the wind was blowing exactly the way I wanted the tree to fall. And somehow, right at the crucial moment, the wind shifts and blows the other direction and catches that big green canopy like a sail, pushing the tree the direction I don't want it to go. You can ask my sons. It amounts to me shouting a lot. Pound that wedge! Pound that! Hit the wedge! We usually make out. Point is, the wind is unreliable. In this case, everybody in Paul's company knows that they ought to be having stiff northeastern winds, but just for the moment, they are experiencing an unusual, unseasonal, gentle southern breeze. So they set out, and boom, the wind changes and starts howling down in a fierce storm from the northeast. And from this point on, there is nothing to do but try to ride out the storm. They know at the moment in which direction they are being blown, and they know that there's a lot of sandbars and shallows in that direction, and that if the ship gets stuck on one of those sandbars with the wind and the waves going like it is, it will beat the ship to pieces. So if you read the rest of the chapter, you see that they passed cables under the hull of the ship and winched it tight across the deck so that if they got hung on the sand, the ship might stay together and they wouldn't all end up in the water. And then they start throwing out the secondary cargo, whatever it was somebody was paying them to haul. Off it goes into the ocean so the boat will rise as high as possible and maybe glide over those sandbars. And then they start tossing out anchors to drag, hoping that if they hit the sandbars, at least they won't hit it quite so hard, quite so fast. You get the impression these men are desperate, and having done all of that, fearing that even these extreme measures may not be enough, they start scouring the ship, and if there's a piece of rope that maybe you can do without, off it goes, and if there's another sail that you're not going to need if you're dead, out it goes, and if there's an extra block and tackle, overboard it goes, and everything that they can throw over is thrown over, hoping to make it possible for them just to live. The storm continues. The ship does not hit the sandbars. Did they miss them? Did they pass over them? No one knows. It has now been days since the clouds allowed any sight of sun or stars, and they have no idea what direction they're going. And the storm shows no signs of letting up, and a consensus is reached. We're toast. This is the point at which Paul speaks up and where Jeff began reading for us. Because Paul is human, he does what God did not do to him in his lowest hour. Paul says, "I told you so! You who should have listened to me, if we had stayed back in that first harbor like I said, we wouldn't be in this mess right now." And then he gets that off his chest and he has good news. "I have had a visit from an angel of the God to whom I belong. I've had that visit this very night, and the angel has told me we are all going to make it. We are all going..." Oh, the ship is history. Forget it. "I hope you have the cargo insured. But we are all going to live." Why should God save this particular crew and company? The ocean floor is littered with the bones and the wreckage of similar groups that did not survive. This group is going to be saved, Paul says, because God has made an entry in Paul's appointment book. Paul must stand before Caesar. And if Paul drowns in the middle of the ocean, he will not stand before Caesar. But God says he will stand before Caesar. And therefore, Paul will not drown in the middle of the ocean. And when Paul gets to Rome, he probably needs to be in the company of Julius, the centurion, who has the official report and papers remanding Paul over to the custody of the Roman court and explaining things. That probably needs to happen. So Julius needs to survive to get to Rome with Paul. And if you're going to get Paul and Julius both out of this fix and back onto shore, I suppose you might as well take the rest of the crew along with them. Paul says God is giving them all their lives for the sake of his appointment in Rome. Good news, if you believe it. Did they believe it? Day 14. 14 days running blindly with the wind, no sight of sun or stars. Day 14, midnight, storm still blowing. The sailors have picked up the kinds of clues to which sailors are attentive, which make them think that they may be nearing land, and they have started taking soundings, and it's this deep, and then it's this deep, and then it's this deep, and they know they're headed for something. The sun comes up, and there is an island. What island? Nobody knows. But it's an island, and we're making right for it at ramming speed. Throw out some more anchors. Toss the weed overboard. Lighten the ship so that we can get as close as possible before we stick in the sand. Paul says there must be no deserters. The ropes to the dinghy are cut and the boat falls away. Somebody believed what Paul was saying. The soldiers want to kill the prisoners. This is understandable. The soldiers understood the Roman law. If somebody escapes, as might well happen while everybody is trying to swim for shore in a big panic melee, if somebody escapes, the soldier responsible for that escaped criminal must bear the penalty that should have fallen on the criminal. Soldiers want to kill them, so there will be no prisoners escape. But killing the prisoners means killing Paul. And Julius the centurion has decided now that his wagon is firmly hitched to Paul. There will be no killing of prisoners. I asked whether the company believed Paul's assertion. Julius apparently did. His wagon is hitched to Paul and his appointment in Rome. All eyes are on the rapidly approaching beach. Everyone's breath is held. Bang. A hidden reef. The boat sticks fast. As predicted, the waves begin knocking it to pieces. People jump overboard. They swim or they grab floating debris. And against all odds, but true to the word of the Lord, all 276 souls soon stand wet, cold, and exhausted on shore. How many of you believe that this constitutes a miracle or an act of divine providence? All right, here's what I want to tell you. You haven't seen the miracle yet. The miracle is still to be revealed. What island is this on which they have come to shore? As it turns out, it is Malta. They had no idea. They had been fleeing before the wind, half the time sailing sideways for 14 days, knowing not what direction they were going. But as it turns out, the island is Malta. Where is Malta? Where is Malta? Malta is one easy day, half day, sailing from Italy and Rome. Where Paul was supposed to be going. In all that time that they had been lost and no one knew in what direction the storm was carrying them, apparently God still knew. How many of us have ever felt, maybe for a moment or maybe for a more extended period of time, that our lives were just out of control? It's an unpleasant feeling. We don't like things being out of control. I am going to tell you that I cannot imagine more out of control than being on a boat with one sail, driven before the wind, in the dark gale, not knowing where I'm going, fearing at any moment that I may hit rocks or sand and the boat may come apart and I may be in the ocean. That seems to me to be out of control. I have never yet watched one of those movies where they show the scene of the boat being overpowered by a storm at sea and thought to myself, man, I wish I was on that boat. Always more like, boy, I'm glad I'm not on that boat. But Paul was on that boat. And to all appearances, looking at external circumstances, everything was out of control. And here's what I need you to know. If you walk with God, your life is never out of control. If you walk with God, whatever your circumstances, you are held in His hand. Lots of decisions were made in the course of this story. One of the last ones was made by Julius the centurion, and he could have made other decisions. His men wanted him to make another decision. His training as a soldier probably inclined him to make another decision. Even as a centurion, he was not immune to the laws about bearing the penalty of escaped prisoners. All he knew was that everything depended on the simple assertion that this God of which he was almost completely ignorant meant for Paul to make it to Rome. And he hitched his wagon to Paul. I imagine Julius's grandchildren still told the story. But in the end, I hope, and we don't know, but I hope that Julius came to understand that it wasn't really Paul, but the God who made the appointment for Paul that mattered. Paul would indeed appear before Caesar, and Paul would die at Caesar's order. God was not opposed to spending Paul's life and blood, just determined to spend it at the right time and the right place. And to many, this seems kind of capricious. Hey, I will save you from drowning so you can be beheaded instead. It can seem gracious. All men are appointed once to die. How many of you believe this is true? All men are appointed once to die. Precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. How many of you believe that that is true? I believe that. God has demonstrated amply that he is able to make good use of our deaths, even the death of his own son when he came as a human being. Furthermore, the most important promises God has made to us concern what happens after we die. And that is the point. You see, Paul had this appointment in Rome, but afterwards he had a bigger, better, more pleasant appointment than the one he would keep with Caesar. And Paul had already begun speaking of this appointment, and as his stay in Rome extended, he would speak of it with increasing frequency, how he was ready to be poured out as a fragrant offering to God, and how, push come to shove, he was perfectly willing to be absent from the body, read, dead, and present with the Lord. There is that final appointment. And it is the knowledge of such an appointment that can keep a man like Paul calm in a ship lost at sea, pitching on the waves, imprisoned in Rome, or kneeling before the man with the axe. And here is the lesson. Hitch your wagon to the will of God. And he has made his will abundantly clear. The problem is that there are so many other horses we think we might like to choose. We might, like Felix, decide that money is the thing that will pull us through and do anything to hitch our wagon to money. But Felix was disappointed by money in the end. We might, like Festus, decide that it is loyalty and devotion to country and political party that will pull us through in the end. But that did not pull Festus through either. We might, like Julius the centurion, find that at some given moment, the thing to do is to hitch our wagons to the particular man of God who has been called for this hour. But even then, we have to avoid confusion. It is not the man, but God. And God's will that pulls us through. I advise us all, hitch our wagons to God's will. And though the whole earth perish, and the earth shall perish, but though it perish, the will of God remains. And if we cling to His purposes, we, like Paul, will be held in His hand in the midst of any storm here, and will keep that final appointment in eternity.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.